So I'm really delighted to introduce Sami Awad to you. He's director of the Holy Land Trust, which put on the inaugural Bethlehem Live Festival in Bethlehem in June this year. I wasn't able to make it to the festival, sadly. Hope to be there next year. But I'm sure Sami will tell you a little bit about it. But I did have the pleasure of meeting Sami in Bethlehem in May, and when I was in the region, and I was really and honestly moved and inspired by the meeting with Sami and his team. To hear about Sami's own journey towards nonviolence and nonviolent activism, as well as to hear about the really innovative work that Holy Land Trust is doing in Bethlehem, I found it a very profound experience. And for those of you that heard Sami speak on Saturday in Jerusalem venue at the Grandstand, one of our very big venue. It was a sellout, and if we were selling tickets for it, that is. And he got a standing ovation. I think everyone that was there seemed to be as inspired as I was by his graciousness, his humility, his forgiving approach to his activism for justice and peace in the region. So I commend him to you as a prophet in our time. Thank you for being here, Sami, and I'll hand over to you.
Okay, good morning, everyone. It's so wonderful to see so many people here and so much energy after all these days of Greenbelt, still surviving and still moving strong. I want to start by reading a verse from the Bible. Which many of you know, but for me, I want to read it in the context of understanding nonviolence and how do we engage in nonviolence, especially to those who are Christian, who follow the Christian faith or seek to follow the teachings of Jesus. I'm sorry, I forgot my Bible at the hotel, so I had to download the verse. But this is the... from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, which, as I said, many of you know very well. And you might wonder, what does this have to do with war and conflict and resistance and nonviolence? But I think you will be able to get it as soon as I begin speaking. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but have no love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship, that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. And I could add to it, if I liberate Palestine, if I end injustice all over the world, if I bring freedom to humankind and have no love, then I am nothing. Love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not dishonor other. It is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered. It keeps no records of wrong. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. This, for me, has become, after many, many years, a core verse of what does it mean for me to engage in nonviolence. As many of you know, I come from a Palestinian background, where I live under what is known as the Israeli military occupation, where I can tell you every moment of my life, since the time I was 6 months old to the time I left to college and came back from college in the U.S., every experience has been an experience of living daily under the wing of injustice of the Israeli military and the violence of the military and settlers. And it's not just the physical violence. It is the structure of violence that continues to control and manipulate our lives as Palestinians. And before we talk about nonviolence as a theory and practice, which for me is very important because this is not a workshop on Palestine, it is about nonviolence, I just want to go a little bit through my own personal journey with you. I grew up in a family that believed in nonviolence. An uncle of mine, who I've mentioned to you before, was fully committed to nonviolence. He established a center in Jerusalem to teach nonviolence to the Palestinian community, engaged in protests, demonstrations, planting trees in lands that were going to be confiscated, bringing Israelis and Palestinians to work together for justice for Palestine. So I grew up fully in that atmosphere. It was part of my growth, part of my development. Never in my mind, even with the anger and hatred that I had in me, never did I think that I would ever revert to violence as a choice. Never would I think that I would carry a gun. I've never carried a gun in my life. Plastic guns, maybe, when I was a child. But never a gun, never shot a bullet from a gun. I would never do that. So that was the atmosphere that I grew up in. Of course, the highlight for us as Palestinians was in the first uprising, in the first Intifada, where Palestinians truly engaged in nonviolence in ways that are even taught today in universities across the world, what Palestinians did in the first Intifada. Books were written on how Palestinians engaged in nonviolence then. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as tactics in a little bit. But for me, in this whole understanding of nonviolence and my learning of nonviolence, learning about Gandhi, learning about Martin Luther King, for me, I always connected it to my faith as a higher spiritual utopian thing that I need to achieve. Never understanding that it is actually in the teachings of Jesus, in this reading, for example, it is a very practical daily living that we engage in. It's not just, you know, wanting to be like Jesus someday when I reach some higher spiritual consciousness or awareness. When Jesus calls us to live out these teachings today, and this was very important for me to understand how nonviolence is not just a tactical, strategic approach to ending conflict or ending occupation due to the lack of weapons, due to the lack of arms, just because I think it is the best option now, and if I had other options, then I would choose them to deal with my oppressor. But it is a real commitment to engaging in this deep expression of love, no matter what the situation is, no matter what the condition is. And this has been my journey throughout these years. If I was here 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I would have given you a completely different presentation. I would have given you a whole understanding of how do we build a strategy for nonviolent resistance to occupations, to oppressions, to injustices around the world. And I'm not saying this is not part of it, but in the teachings that we follow, there's much more to it than just that. And for me, as I mentioned before, one of the deepest processes for me has been to not just engage in nonviolence as what I am doing to the oppressor, where I can boast about myself how I am a nonviolent person, how I am a peaceful person, but in my nonviolent actions, I am actually demonizing and dehumanizing the oppressor. And this is very important because as a person, as a community that has continuously been demonized and dehumanized, we think that in our resistance, we are trying to address our demonization. But how often do the demonized and dehumanized engage in a process of doing the same to others? And this was a very important learning point for me in my path through nonviolence. That nonviolence does not call me to demonize and dehumanize, but to honor the humanity of those who are even committing the gravest sin against me. The other component of my learning was to begin to see how in my nonviolence, I would claim this physical violence, the physical nonviolence, claim to be physically nonviolent, but in my heart, in my soul, there was a lot of violence. In my heart and in my soul, there was not just anger, which is actually legitimate, because you have to be angry when you see injustice, but a lot of hatred, a lot of resentment towards those who were doing this to me. To be standing in front of soldiers or settlers and claiming to be nonviolence in the eyes of the media or in the eyes of activists, but in my heart, having a lot of violence was for me a very important point to begin to understand, and how it was my process of my own personal transformation which was needed in order for me to reach a point where I can still do these actions, commit to resistance, but truly doing it coming out of a heart of love, of compassion, of even understanding, not justification, but understanding the other, the enemy, no matter how brutal they were towards me. What I want to share practically with you, and you know, this is something that we do for 4 days intensely when we do these trainings, so we have about 50 minutes to do this work with you. But what I would call it is a taster. It's like an introduction to the methodology that we are using in Holy Land Trust, working with Palestinians mostly, but with also Israelis, on how do we help people reach this point of understanding, to engage in nonviolent actions from a completely different level of consciousness and mindfulness than just engaging in nonviolence to react to the other, or because I don't have weapons to fight them, then I will choose nonviolence, which is the pragmatic way of looking at resistance and nonviolence. So it's going to be a combination of two schools of thought that we're going to talk about today. One school of thought is to begin, as I said, to begin to understand myself. Who am I being in the face of any conflict and any issue that I want to address? Now, all of you, and I hope all of you, at least many of you, are involved in social justice, economic justice, environmental justice issues, either locally or globally. I think this is what Greenbelt is about. It's a gathering of people who are actively involved and wanting to end some sense of oppression or injustice that exists in the world. And so what I'm hoping is, as we're doing this training or workshop together, is that you look at it in terms of how you are engaging in whatever you're doing. And maybe, you know, I want to say there is no truth, an ultimate truth in what I'm saying. This, I'm sharing my own personal process with the hope that we engage and we learn together in this process. And towards the end, we'll open it up for questions, answers, comments as well. We won't have time to do group work and, you know, circles and so on today as we usually do. So please accept this just as me speaking to you now, and then we'll give you room to speak later. One of the most important aspects that I had to learn in my process is what we refer to as distinguished-based learning. This is a concept that was very new to me. I learned this about 5 years ago. And for me, it was very important to see what does it mean to be able to distinguish, not distinguish one thing from the other, not to distinguish black from white, but to really begin to ask the question, what allows me as a person to think the way I think? What allows me as a person to look at something and say, I can engage in this or I cannot engage in this? And this was a very important learning for me. And I think we got a board coming here, which is going to help me explain this more to you. Great. So if I ask a question, we as human beings, what do we seek to achieve in life? Just throw words out. What is it that you seek in your life?
Happiness.
Happiness? security. What?
Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
All right. Success. Children. Love. Money. Shelter. To do God's will in my life. Purpose. Peace. Freedom. We seek these things for us or for others. Many of you I know are actively involved in these things for the Palestinian community as well. If we put all of these words in one word, if we have one title that we put all of these words under, what would that one word be? Everything that you said.
Harmony.
Harmony, fulfillment, shalom, well-being. All right, let's... let's put this word and see if you agree with me or not. As human beings, we are created to seek results. Okay? Anything you do in your life actually is for results that you want to achieve. Many of you are in Green Belt to achieve results, right? Here to learn, to worship, to deepen your theology, to run away from home for a little while because your wife is something. Or we are here to achieve results. We eat to achieve results, right? We breathe to achieve results. We dress to achieve results. So part of this understanding is that as human beings, we have this natural tendency within us to always seek to achieve results in our life. Now, if we put this on a scale with a time frame, and we look at each one's life, if you look at your life and of my life, by the time when I was born, I was pretty much here, and the results that I achieved were pretty much here as well. So I was born in moment zero, and I wasn't able to achieve many results in my early days, well, very smelly results, maybe. But that's how we start. If you look into a project, if you look into an activity, if you look into a campaign. For example, yesterday we launched Kairos. I think many of you were there. So if we look at, there was a launch, there was a moment of launch, and this time that happened. And of course, what we hope is that as we move in time and grow, then we will be able to achieve more results in our life, right? If I look at the organization that I'm part of, Holy Land Trust, when we started 15 years ago, we started in a small radio station with one desk and four chairs around it. The results we were achieving in the community were very little. As we learned and as we moved and as we progressed and as we achieved results, we were able to build on them and achieve more and more and more. So this is our tendency, as I think this is how God created us. We are human beings who have a real desire, as a creation, maybe unlike other creatures, we have a real desire to achieve things in our life. We don't just live to die. We don't just eat to have just the circle of life functioning, just to have the species continue to exist. We look at human history, where we were and where we are now. It's all about results. Now, of course, at a certain point, we reach in our life the present moment. And if I ask any of you and all of you, what are the results that you want to achieve in your future, you will probably say that, yeah, I mean, I still want to achieve results. I'm not satisfied just where I've reached, especially if, again, we're talking about issues of concern to us, environmental, social, political, economic justice issues. We want to continue achieving results. We're not satisfied yet with the issue of ending occupation. What is more that we have to do? And we could actually predict, you know, we had a meeting today with some of the Kairos members. looking towards the future. What are the things we want to do? What are the results that we want to do? Nobody says we want to go back in the results. We want to achieve less than what we have achieved. We always seek to achieve more than what we have achieved in the past. Anybody disagree with this? Is this good? Okay, so far. All right. So, my biggest laboratory for this theory or this methodology is actually my family. I have three girls, and I have a 2-year-old, a 6-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And I look at each of them and see what are the results each one is achieving, and what is the results that each one wants to create for the future. And it's amazing, I mean, to look at them and to see where they are now and what they want to achieve. And if you could imagine, you know, the 11-year-old, if I ask her, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? What are some things that she would say? A pop star, a doctor, engineer, school teacher. Well, children at that age, pop star is quite a big one, of course. So she has dreams. You know, we all have dreams as to what we want to achieve for the future. Of course, you know, if you ask me, what do I want to be when I grow up at 42? I don't have these big, you know, dreams. I'm not going to come here on main stage next year and sing for you as a pop star. But I have. I mean, I still want to stay, of course, within the sphere of the work that I do. Maybe achieve bigger results than what this history has allowed me to achieve. But for her, she's really got, you know, big dreams, a wide imagination. If I ask my 6-year-old daughter what she wants to be when she grows up, what do you think she would say? Every 6-year-old girl in the world wants to do the same. A princess, of course. And she's actually convinced. I mean, I'm worried about how much she's convinced that she will be a princess one day. So her results are big. She's going straight up. I'm going to be a princess. I'm going to marry a prince, and I'm going to live in a big castle. And I'm going to ride a horse, the whole deal. Now, what happens in society, and look, how does this relate to all this work of nonviolence? This will relate. What happens in society is that if this 6-year-old girl is 20 years old and still wants to be a princess, what happens to me as a father? I failed. I get embarrassed. You know, imagine this girl with this pink dress, this woman with this pink dress and a little plastic crown on her head walking in the streets of Bethlehem. I'm Sammy's daughter. I'm going to be a princess. I'm waiting for Prince Charming to come and marry me. So what happens actually is that with time, sadly actually I say, we begin to limit what are the results that we allow people to achieve in the future. So the 11-year-old, yes, she wants to be all of these things. But by the time she's 18, you know, okay, what are you really good at to focus on? So is it a school teacher? Is it a doctor, an engineer, a housewife? Whatever job there is, we begin to limit the results. I don't ask the 2-year-old because when I ask her, I don't understand what she says. So she's way out there still in the results she wants to achieve. The challenge for us is that when we reach a certain point in our life where two things become available for us, or two options. The first is that we do not feel that the results that we want to achieve are going to be achieved in our lifetime. That this is a long-term picture, but we want to allow it to happen here. Or the opposite of this, where actually we reach a point where we begin to predict that in the future, with time, the results are not going to be even at the level where we have reached now. What do we do in this situation? If you look into, again, the context of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and you begin to ask Palestinians at this point where we have reached, do you believe in peace with the Israelis? Do you see peace coming with the Israelis? You will get the two polar answers. One group of people will tell you, never, it cannot happen. And one group of people will tell you, if I had another four sheets here, maybe in 100 years, maybe in 3 or 4 generations, there will be peace. If you look at Israelis and ask them, can there be peace with the Palestinians? Do you see a prospect of peace with the Palestinians? Interestingly, you'll get the same answers. There will never be peace with them. There will never be this result that will be achieved with them. Or maybe in generations to come. So instead of being up here, the question is, what if we want to achieve this result? Not wait forever, but to achieve this result in a shorter period of time than what this line allows for? Or how do we take people from here to here? This is what I'm talking about, this personal transformation. Because for me, if I want to engage in any resistance, any activity that can achieve results, and this is what my job is. My job is to achieve results. Peace in the Holy Land. This is what I want to do. How do I achieve this? And what personally needs to be formed in myself in order to get an understanding of this? And this is where I go back to this learning of distinctions that I mentioned earlier. One of the biggest distinctions that we teach those who take our training programs, our nonviolence training programs, is to begin to create one of the clearest distinctions that many of us don't even know about, is that as human beings, we're not just created to achieve results, but we're also created to understand that in our memory, we actually create distinctions between something called the past, the present, and the future. And if you return and ask the Palestinians, why do you think it's going to take us 3 generations? Or why do you think peace will never be achieved in the Holy Land? What will they refer to? The past. Now, we don't understand this as a distinction, but they will tell you, look what they've done to us. Look what they're doing to us, which, of course, is the past. Even if something happened yesterday, it's the past, as we know. So everything about the past tells us that in the present, we cannot make a decision for the future that will achieve results or results to be up here. And again, if you talk to Israelis, they will tell you, look what they have done to us. Look at the bombs. Look at the terror attacks. Look at the rockets. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this. Our experience in the past tells us that in the present, we cannot make a decision that would allow for this future to be. This is the biggest point of beginning the process of inner personal transformation. And the challenge is, how do we create this distinction within me where I begin to understand that, aha, I am actually allowing the past to decide in the present what I'll do in the future. Now, we do this as I get subconsciously. We don't even think about this. For example, you know, if I want to test the effect of gravity on human beings, I know the theory, right? Because somebody actually tested. Somebody actually stood on a big building like this one and jumped, and we saw what happened to him. So everything from the past, and this is important, all our decisions that we make in the present to achieve results in the future are determined by the past. Are determined by the past. Everything. Either the past we experienced, some others experienced, we learned about, others learned about and talked about. All of the past is what allows for me to make a decision in the present for the future. Our engagement in nonviolence is also based on this. When we engage in nonviolent activities, protests, demonstrations, We do them not because just we want to do them, because we actually believe we could achieve results. But they're based, again, on the past. And this is where one of the biggest important points of nonviolence becomes important, is that nonviolence, what happens then, it becomes a reaction to what happened in the past. Instead of seeing how can we develop nonviolence as a proactive movement towards what we want to achieve in the future. So if you look into your own process, how you have engaged in issues, social issues, political issues, environmental issues, are we stuck in a domain where it is a circle connecting only the past to the present, which, as I said, it's not wrong, but this is how our natural tendency seems to be. We learn from the past. We use the past to do our actions in the present. And, of course, anything that happens to us in the present goes into our filing system, our memory, you know, the hard drive up here, and we refer to that in the future. So if I engage in a nonviolent protest or an action, for example, in the present that does not achieve a result, I put that in my memory. And then I think, well, I don't know if I want to do that next time. As I mentioned in the Jerusalem, you know, the reasons we do the things we do is because of this relationship. And of course, all of this affects how our future is formed. What we want to challenge leaders, including yourself, including leaders who are engaged in nonviolence in Palestine, in Israel, in the global community, is how do we create this distinction where instead of saying I'm allowing the past to decide what are the decisions I'm making in the present for the future, to actually be able to say I want the future to be the catalyst of the decisions I make in the present in order to achieve that future. And this is where we are now in the nonviolent movement in Palestine and Israel, in the Holy Land. Not just looking into how do I engage in nonviolence simply as revenge and retaliation for what happened to me in the past and be lost in this circle, but to ask what is the future we want to create? Honoring the past, respecting the past, definitely learning from it, not to repeat the mistakes, but at the same time is completely independent from the past. This is one of the most important, as I said, distinctions that we want to focus on in our work, and hopefully as you begin to think, what are the actions, what are the activities, what are the things that you are involved in, for you to look, how often do you get trapped and stuck in this circle, instead of looking into how do I engage in this circle, the present and the future. And the moment I'm able to create the distinction, then I'm able to look at this, what is the vision? What is the dream, the possibility that I want to achieve? And then look at how do I engage in this. The choice of engaging in violence, in my opinion, in this context, then does not exist. Because most of the engagement in violence comes out of fear that we learn from the past. As the Bible has clearly stated, and this is something that I fully believe in, is that when it comes to the opposite of love, it is fear. And fear and love lead us. These are two emotions that are the strongest emotions in humankind, in human beings. It's not anger that leads me, and I might call it anger. It's not the need for security that leads me, and I might call it the need for security. It's fear of losing that leads me. But the moment I'm able to express it through love, then there is no place for fear. There's only love to engage in. And this is where, for me, the the power of engaging in the Bible in our daily life comes in. It's not just a lovey-dovey, let's all hug each other and sing kumbaya. That's not the power that's being expressed by these statements in the Bible. For me, it is a real strong power of love that, as you say, can move mountains even. So this is the framework that we create for us to begin engaging in nonviolence. Well, let me move on to some very practical things, because the question is, how do we do this? How do we move from this into the practical engagement of nonviolence? And this afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit about, the question is, where is the Gandhian Palestinian or the Gandhi of Palestine? But in this time, I want to refer to a person who really maybe understood this without even knowing this theory, which is Martin Luther King in the civil rights movement and in his engagement in nonviolence. And for me, I want to give certain principles of nonviolence that Martin Luther King mentioned, but also talk about practical steps that we could engage in that can allow for us to create this distinction and begin moving forward in what do we want to achieve. One of the most important points for people who want to commit to nonviolence is to understand that actually nonviolence is not for everybody. Now, we assume that, and we say this all the time, that nonviolence is an opportunity where everybody can do something, everybody can engage. And it's true. Actually, a child can engage in nonviolence, and a retired grandmother can engage in nonviolence. The question is, what is the type of person that engages in nonviolence? And I stand to claim that to engage in nonviolence, it takes people who are very courageous. It takes people of real courage to engage in active resistance. And this is the challenge again to you. How courageous are you in what you want to achieve in your life, in your cause, and in your issue? How easily are you blown away by the pressures of society and the community, let alone any violent reaction that you might face by engaging in this work? So nonviolence is active, and it is an active resistance to evil. And it is not easy to resist evil, as we know. But this is what it is about. It takes courageous people. In our training, we say, it is actually quite easy for me as a militant to stand 500 yards away from a tank and shoot at it as it's coming towards me. The question is, what would allow for me to stand unarmed in front of the tank, ready to lose my life, and allow this tank to ride over me, just like what Rachel Corrie and other activists around the world have done? What is that courage that is needed to do that? Do I have the courage to even do that? So nonviolence is a way of life for the courageous people. Another value of nonviolence is not just about resisting the other. Nonviolence is an attempt to win the friendship and the understanding of those who oppose you. And this might sound very strange to people, because many people talk about nonviolence as resistance. Our goal when we engage in nonviolence is not just to resist. Resistance is a means to achieve a goal. And when we are called for loving the enemy, when we are called to loving the neighbor, this is what we seek to do. As I mentioned yesterday, it's not about going around and hugging every Israeli and every soldier. I might end up in prison actually for doing that, not for being violent towards them. But my goal in my engagement in nonviolence is actually to win the heart of those who oppose me. It is this goal that I believe Jesus called us to do, which is seeking this community, this oneness of humanity, the breakup of all the walls of separation that exists between us, mental, physical, spiritual separation. The third value of nonviolence is that it seeks to defeat the injustice, and it seeks to defeat the evil, but not the humans that engage in this work. It is not a fight against people. This is why when we talk about nonviolence, we seek nonviolence not to be physically, mentally, or spiritually harming for those who you resist and fight. It's not just not being physical to them. If I am in a nonviolent demonstration and there are soldiers that are standing there and I'm being physically nonviolent, but I've used every bleep word in the dictionary, am I nonviolent or not? I would actually say I'm very violent in these moments. And I challenge even myself deeper, as I said before, it's not even in what I act physically or what I say verbally, but even what is the heart that I have in me? What is the energy that I project to the other without even saying or moving a single hand? Do I have an energy of love and compassion in my nonviolent action or not? So this is, as I said, it's a deep spiritual process as well. So it's defeating injustice, not people. The fourth point and value of nonviolence, it is the willingness to suffer. Many people ask the question, well, if you engage in nonviolence, then they are not going to respond. They're violent to your nonviolence. How do you accept this? There is no give and take in this. Once you commit to nonviolence as a value and a principle of life, you actually have to be ready, and not just ready, be prepared to have the other respond to you in violence, with the hope that ultimately they will change this behavior. What we have seen throughout history, if it's Gandhi in India, Martin Luther King, anywhere where nonviolence has happened, the systems that are oppressive will usually and firstly react with violence, because nonviolence is a greater threat to them than violence. And they will try to suppress nonviolence very quickly. And this was the experience that we as Palestinians had in the onset of the Second Intifada. In the onset of the Second Intifada, what we saw happen was a very fierce, violent reaction by the Israeli military towards Palestinians when we were even beginning to develop the nonviolent protest movement. If many of you remember, the first part of the Second Intifada in the year 2000 actually was about protests and demonstrations in the streets. And then all of a sudden, the reaction was very violent, because there was an attempt to suppress nonviolence, because the Israeli military, and many of you have read reports on this, actually has come out declaring that it is much more impossible or difficult for them to engage with Palestinian nonviolence than with Palestinian violence. And they will try to suppress this as soon as possible. And this is what they want. They want to defeat a nonviolent movement from evolving. So you have to be ready to accept suffering, to accept violence, to accept even being a casualty in the struggle. The fifth value of nonviolence is your full commitment to choosing love over fear and hatred. Again, linked to this issue of accepting the violence from the other, how do you accept this with complete forgiveness and with complete love to those who have done this to you? And there is no example greater in our life than Jesus on the cross, with everything that he went through, all the physical violence that he went through, understanding that forgiveness and love is his reaction to that. But love is active, it's not passive. Love does not sink to the level of the perpetrator towards you. And I think understanding the deep essence of love is in this personal transformation, where it's not, when you love, you have a heart of love fully. And this is not just a love for the other, it is even a greater love for yourself. The sixth value of nonviolence, when it comes to achieving results, is for us to understand that ultimately God stands on the side of justice. And somehow we seem to forget this. We allow this to be our own personal battle, our own personal struggle, completely ignoring God's will for all of humanity, which means we don't even allow ourselves to trust God in this process. And I think sometimes as activists, we become, in a sense, our own gods and our own worlds in terms of our ego and how we struggle for the issues that we care about. And I think we need to learn more and more to surrender to God. And not just to say, I'll let God resolve it, but to understand that ultimately God stands on the side of justice. And God, our God, is a God that hates injustice. So these are the values of nonviolence that we train and engage in, which are very important for us. And I'll end by saying that for me, this is all related to what we're doing here. So my challenge to you is that when you return to your communities, when you return to your activism, look deeply into what you are engaging in and what is the heart you are engaging in and what are the results you want to achieve. I know many of you who are very active for Palestine, for the issue of justice and peace in the Holy Land. And as much as I commend you for being for peace and justice for the Palestinian community, for seeking to end the occupation, I want to challenge you, even from this place where I have you all as friends, if you have anger, hatred, and fear from the Jewish community, from the Israeli community, I beg you to engage in a process that would allow for this to end. We do not want this. My goal is not to have activists for Palestine hating Jews and hating Israel. We want activists that love both communities and seek the best for both communities. Thank you, and may God bless you.
Thank you very much for your talk. You're probably well aware that yesterday there was a group of people say Christian Zionists outside the main gate of Greenbelt. And some of my friends and I have tried to talk to them. It was really tough. And it made me realize that if your starting point is so different, it's really hard to come closer and to come to some kind of understanding. And I'm not sure if I believe in God. And I'm quite sure that I don't take the Bible literally. And they do. And they said in the Bible it says so and so, and therefore Israel has a right to have a state there. And it was really hard to argue with them or to even start explaining anything, because if they believe that as a fact, how can I argue with that?
Yeah.
And I wonder what to do in this situation, because many of my friends finally, you know, went away and were like, there's no use in talking to them. I remained really friendly and we had some conversation, but it's really difficult if, you know, your starting point is so different.
Yeah.
And then so what to do with that? And the other question about this is, do you sort of, some people were saying we shouldn't give them an audience, so don't talk to them and just leave them there. But then I'm from the Netherlands and we have these right-wing politicians there, and they call that, when people don't want to talk to them, they say there is this cordon sanitaire around them where no one wants to talk to them, and they use that again to gain media attention. But then talking to them is kind of frustrating, and does that help, or do they feel their action was very effective because they spoke to me, or should I talk or should I not talk to them? Hoping for some answers. Thank you.
I met the Zionists yesterday as well. I only went to the gate to meet my daughter who was coming for the day. And I sort of tried to start off asking them what was it they believe. And they said to me that they believe that the Jews are very, very special to God. And I said to them, does that mean that you feel that the Palestinians are less special then? And I started to talk about the wall and the peace process. And I said, I really feel that until that wall comes down, that any peace process will totally fail. And they were saying that the wall is their protection. And I was saying, but The wall is actually imprisoning a people who have to go through checkpoints to get medication, education, you know, and fundamental rights of life. And I said, surely you wouldn't even want to treat your dog, you know, in the way that you're treating these people imprisoning them. And, you know, yeah. Actually, they were quite arrogant in the way that they were putting over how special they were. And I just felt, actually, very similar to South Africa and the way that they were using the Bible in South Africa to say that they were special to God, you know. Yeah. These people, these Zionists, you know, were actually using the same argument. And was I really, was I in a way kind of being violent, saying, you know, you wouldn't treat your dog like that. So why would you treat, you know, these people?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I was violent, but I did put my argument in a very forthright way.
All right, thank you. No. Yeah, thank you for this. I actually went as well and tried to greet them yesterday morning, but I had to go to another session, so I wasn't able to spend much time with them, and I would have loved to. And I actually asked them if they could stay later, but maybe that would have been violent if they stayed outside the whole time as well. But if we look at this again from this approach, we understand that emotion takes over. We understand that, yes, as I said, there is anger. And anger, when we hear the things they say, I believe is justified. I mean, the Bible says even how many times Jesus got angry with what he saw. So it's very important for us to allow this anger to exist. The question, the challenge for us is, once we have this energy of anger, where do we take it? And how do we take it to the next level? And it's easy to become hateful. It's easy to become fearful. It's easy to become violent even towards them, verbally and insulting them. And you don't understand anything. You don't know anything. But I think what's also very important is to look into what are steps that we need to take. It's not just in this one conversation where this issue will be resolved. People like myself, Mark Braverman, I think he's here as well. We've been engaging with groups like this for years now, for years. And we are beginning to see things move. We are beginning to see that wall crack, small cracks even within it. But this wall, which is called Christian Zionism, as a theology, as a theory, as an institution, economic, political power institution, is beginning to crack. The steps that are the steps of nonviolence, the first important step is we need to have our information right. You need to be able to gather factual information. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges that we have, especially when we are emotionally driven. As I was mentioning yesterday in the Jerusalem session, speak the fact as the fact. What is the violence? What is the wall? What is the injustice that is happening? And speak it in particular. What is exactly happening? Because we sometimes like to amplify facts. We like to sometimes spice up facts. And I think it's very important for us to gather the right information. The second step is we need to educate others. What we need to understand is that, sadly, many of these people are not educated as to what is the reality. Like you were saying, we need to educate them. What is happening on the ground? Educate them also about the Jewish voices that are standing in opposition to what they're saying, because they feel that what they're doing is something that is not good for the Jewish community as well, not just for the Palestinians. So speak a language that is accepted in their listening. And I think this is very important as the second point, to educate them. The third point is to remain committed to what you are engaging in. Never give up. That's very crucial, because sometimes you reach this point where we've got all the facts, we've talked to everybody we could talk to, and nobody's listening to us, we're giving up. This is where you have to be committed to what you engage in. The next point after that is to what we call to negotiate. We think after that you usually go to resistance, but what's important at this point is to negotiate. You need to negotiate with them. You need to talk to them. You need to find what is the common ground. And negotiate is not on Palestine and Israel. To negotiate with them on what is the relationship of trust and respect that you could build with them as members of your country or your community, as members of the church. What is the foundation that we agree on no matter what? Let's put all of these issues aside. What do we agree on? If then, and this is what actually Martin Luther King says, after all of this, if you're not able to achieve results, then you go into action and activism, nonviolent direct action. Then what you engage in is, yes, this is where their mind is so blocked and so closed from the reality that you begin to engage in action. But the only reason you engage in action is so that you would return back to that point of negotiation again, not to engage in action for the sake of action. This is where protesting, demonstrating, doing vigils. I don't know how many of you have done vigils in front of their churches telling them what you think they are doing is wrong. Have you done that? Anybody? Vigils, protest, like what they did here. Like what they did here yesterday. They don't know. You know, we've become victimized to them without us ever actually reaching out and communicating with them, either through talk or through action. We just assume that they are who they are and will never change. So what are the actions that we will do that would allow for us to return to this point of negotiating with them again? And ultimately, the ultimate goal is, the last step in this process is reaching a point of reconciliation. Reconciling with those who we disagree with. So these are the steps we recommend. And I think what I have seen in my personal experience, and Mark can also attest to this, is that results can be achieved when we do this. Last year, I was given an opportunity to speak in a place where I don't think any Palestinian would have ever been invited to speak in 5 years ago. Anybody know a place called Regents University? Anybody know the name Pat Robertson? Okay. Regents University is what Pat Robertson established. They had a big conference to bring right-wing Christian Zionist leaders. 800 Christian leaders were there. Pentecostal, charismatic, Church of God, Assemblies of God, that whole conglomeration of activists, including Pat Robertson himself being there, to speak a language that they can listen to and understand was so powerful, where I don't give any thanks to myself, but to God's grace, in a 4-day conference, my presentation was the only one that got a standing ovation. And I did not speak anything different than what I speak to you over here. But they understood that in their theology, in their message, what they have ignored and neglected and forgotten somehow is this core essence of love. And the moment you open up, you say, I'm not against, because they assume we're against Jews, we're against Israelis. I'm not against. What am I for? And this is why this message, I said, be agents of peace and justice and reconciliation for all the peoples of the Holy Land. And I think with this, you will have a different space of listening to them. But build this trust and respect between you and them first before you start having these conversations.